Thelema, Coast to Coast, show number 40, March 31st, 2007. Do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law. Welcome to Thelema Coast to Coast. My name is John Crow, and I'm the host of the show. Before getting into the show, I want to remind everyone there are a number of ways to contact the podcast. The first is via email at podcast@thelemacoasttocoast.com, through the website at www.thelemacoasttocoast.com, through the voicemail at 206-600-5782, through the mailing address at Thelema Coast to Coast, care of John Crow, P.O. Box 7045, Marietta, Georgia, 30065. And through the MySpace page at www.myspace.com/Thelema Coast to Coast. And of course, there is the Frapper map that you can get to on the Thelema Coast to Coast website. It's got hundreds of people on it worldwide, and it's great to see, and I encourage everybody to get on that. And I want to thank everybody who's been sending in postcards. I've got a whole bunch of them, and I've responded to a number of them. I've still got a few more to respond to, and then I'll be getting those scanned up. I think I have about a dozen to put on the website, so thank you. A reminder to everyone that if you want a postcard, you need to include your mailing address. Some of the postcards just have emails on them or just even a thank you, but I need a mailing address to obviously send you the bumper stickers. And for those who don't know, if you send a postcard, any postcard to Thelema Coast to Coast, care of John Crow, P.O. Box 7045, Marietta, Georgia 30065 in the USA, then I will send you a Thelema Coast to Coast bumper sticker. And of no cost or anything, just for the postcard and the postage to send it to me. And then I scan them in and put them on the Thelema Coast to Coast website. I love the variety of cards I've gotten and the great well wishes and messages from everybody. So the first thing I want to do is get into some of the voicemails and emails, because it's been a month or a little over a month since I've done a podcast. I've got a number of them. So I'm going to start with the voicemails first. The first one is from a listener named Brendan, and here is his voicemail.
Hey, John. Do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law. This is Brendan. I'm a longtime listener, as you probably know, and I finally got a chance to give you a call. I'm also an OTL member. I've been a member for almost 10 years now. And I'm getting kind of frustrated with the inability of the OTL leadership to keep the Crowley text in print. I know this is something you've touched on tangentially in your show, so I was wondering if maybe you had an update in this area, or maybe I could just borrow your bully pulpit for a while and kind of give a little shout-out to some of the OTL leadership and let them know how I feel about that. I heard a rumor today that some of the key texts like Magic Without Tears are going to be pulled from Hermetic.com. And as you know, Magic Without Tears is not in print anymore, and the most recent one that was in print that you can get for around $40 is the Regarity edited version. The original version is like hundreds and hundreds of dollars, if it's even available. And this isn't the only text that like this. I mean, the Equinox is not available. The Oriflame is not available. I'm curious why this is the case. In this day and age, with things like Lulu Press and on-demand printing available, for the price of a computer, which you can get for around $300 these days, and a copy of Adobe to make a PDF, a scanner, maybe call it $500, and some volunteer time, which I know the OTO has, because I volunteer a lot of time for them myself, you can get every single piece of holy material that we have on the internet available for someone to buy on an on-demand basis. And Lulu Press will do the hosting, so you don't even have to pay for that. So I don't get it. I just don't get it. And I'm sure there's a really good reason. I'd just like to hear it. So maybe you have an answer for me there, and maybe they can come on and give an answer. And, you know, educate us as to why, if it won't cost them anything to host the material and make it available to the public, they can't manage to actually make this happen. So, thanks very much for letting me borrow your soapbox, and I'll leave another voicemail on something happier, I hope, in the future. Love is the law, love under will.
Brendan, thanks for sending that in. Yeah, the fact that the Curly books are going out of print, especially, as we've mentioned before, Magic Without Tears and so forth, it is very frustrating. As far as the Hermetic.com, it's important to note that that was run by a gentleman who is no longer in the OTO and no longer considers himself a Thelemite. So he thought it was better if it was transferred to somebody. I got an email from him, and he told me that he is in the process, at that time was in the process. I don't know if it's completed now, but was in the process of transferring Thelema Coast to Coast, of transferring Hermetic.com to somebody within the OTO, since it is the hosting provider of a number of OTO people. As for the removing of those documents, I don't know. He said that there was a number of documents that they said they might remove, but he did not know if that was going to happen. And the list was preliminary that he gave me, so it's nothing that I can repeat. It is disappointing that the OTO wants to remove the only source for these documents. However, I know a lot of people or a lot of websites have been out there copying the various documents from Hermetic.com, and if they're still there, I might advise everybody to get their own copies of Magic Without Tears, the commentaries, and so forth, because those are possibly going to be disappearing. As far as the Curly books going out of print, yeah, that's also very disappointing, but I don't want to get into that too much because that is the main topic that Keith 418 and I talk about on this podcast, so I'll refer you to that and where we get into it in a little more in depth. So thanks for that voicemail. The next voicemail is from a Clinton. He sent a voicemail before about going to Finland and looking for the Finnish Lieber All.
93. John, this is Clinton. I'm just following up on my last feedback note that I was looking for Book of the Law and Finnish for you, and as it turns out, you couldn't have put that note in a better podcast as a reminder to me, because when I came back from Finland nearly empty-handed, I looked around on the internet and happened to find a translation on someone's website. So I emailed them and asked them about it, seeing if there was one in print anywhere. And they said that I couldn't have emailed them at a better time because they're getting ready to publish it for the first time. It should be out about the 20th of March, a few days from now. So, yeah. I emailed you all the information for the company putting it out and everything, and I think that would be a pretty good thing to put out on your Really You email list. So, there you are. Love is the law, love under will.
Clinton, thanks for the voicemail and thanks for looking. I do have that information that you sent me. I appreciate it. And it's not the most appropriate to put on the podcast, but what I am going to do is on the next Hurilu mailing list thing that's going to be going out probably in the next week or so, I'll be including that information about how people can get a copy of the Finnish Lieber All if they're interested. So thanks for sending that in, and thanks for getting that information. Okay, the next voicemail is a longer one. It's from Derek, and he wanted to respond to April's question and David Shoemaker's response about Jungian psychology. It looks like this thread has actually kind of piqued a lot of people's interest because they there has been a number of emails about it too, which I'll be going into after this. So here's Derek's voicemail. It's about 5 minutes long. And in fact, it does get cut off at the end because Derek did hit the 5 minute limit on a voicemail. So it does stop abruptly, but that's just the voicemail that I got.
Hi, John. This is Derek from Phoenix, Arizona. I'm calling because I wanted to resurface a question raised by Amber in show 38 about the relevance of Carl Jung's work to magic. Dave Shoemaker, in response to her question, mentioned a couple general concepts of Jung's and their relationship to magic, but it's such a fruitful area of study and praxis as well that I wanted to bring up a couple additional ideas that weren't explicitly mentioned. I personally feel that a study of Jung is indispensable to the practicing magician, not only for the personal psychological insight, but also, and maybe more so, for the exploration of the basic form and function of the psyche and its components. I think the key to correlating Jung and magic is really the psychology of the Kabbalah. As Dave mentioned, the ego-self axis that Jung writes about is basically the relationship with one's HGA. The Ruach represents the ego, which controls and directs and inhabits the Nefesh, which is, of course, the emotional, instinctual, astral body, which in turn animates the physical body. The fulfillment of the Ruach is basically the descent of the angel, the descent of the Briatic intelligence, which allows the Ruach to directly communicate with the supernal principles, the Neshama, Kiya, and Yakida, just as the Nefesh allows the Ruach to experience the physical world. To put that into kind of Jungian terms, with a little spin, granted, the Neshama it corresponds to the formative principle, the anima principle, or female principle, while the Kiya is the causal male animus principle. The Yakida would be the true self, the divine spark, the kind of tether principle. The attainment of the adept is basically described by Jung as what he calls individuation, which is basically the integration of the conscious mind, the Ruach, with both the higher unconscious, the realm of the archetypes, again, what Dave mentioned, you know, the world of absolutes, as well as the lower unconscious, or the world of Yetzirah. So Jung's work is quite literally at the heart of the Western esoteric tradition. I think a few of his books should be required reading for any magician, any serious magician. Mysterium Conjunctionis, Psychology and Alchemy, and Structure and Dynamics of the Psyche, to name a few, that probably have the most direct bearing on magic. But in the same token, Jung was approaching the great work from the realm of psychology. So as anyone reads those works, there do turn up apparent incongruities between his findings and his methodology and ours, but really further meditation on that is really fruitful ground for more insight. One last thing, aside from Jung's own works, I can't recommend highly enough the Magical Philosophy series of books by Melita Denning and Osborne Phillips. To anyone interested specifically in this topic, or magic in general, volume 2 of that series, The Sword and the Serpent, talks about this in great detail, these concepts of Jungian psychology and their relationship to magic. The authors of the book were practitioners of the Ogdoadic system of magic. Actually, you previously interviewed someone some time ago, Joseph Amara, from the Ordo Astrum Sophia, which is also in that same tradition of Ogdoadic magic. So that's a fantastic resource for anyone interested in this. Anyway, John, I hope that was fruitful information for your listeners and yourself, really. You said you didn't have much experience with you, and I think you'd find it fascinating. And I just wanted to tell you I really enjoy the podcast.
Again, Derek, thank you very much for sending that and mentioning those books and those authors. As I've said before, this is not an area that I can claim much knowledge on or any kind of detailed knowledge. So that is absolutely necessary to get that kind of feedback. So thanks for sending that in. Okay, so in that vein, I want to read a few emails that I've gotten from listeners who wanted to respond to more of those comments. The first one is from Freighter OX, and he says, 93, brother, I'm a big fan of your podcast. I think you're performing a real service to the Thelemic community. My favorite segment of all times was the interview with Freighter Akkad's son. I hope you'll find more opportunities like that to use the podcast to document occult history. I note that on the last few podcasts, various people have expressed the common misconception that Israel Regardi was an adherent of the depth psychology of Jung, etc. I assume this is because Jung's theories are so popular with many occultists. But Regardi was not a Jungian, he was a Reichian. That is, he worked with the theories and techniques pioneered by Wilhelm Reich, who is to Jung what magic is to mysticism. Reich was a favored student of Freud's, who chose to scientifically explore the implication of Freud's theories. This required him to take a frank look at human sexuality, which outraged the Victorian moral sense of the rest of Freud's inner circle. Reich went well beyond his mentor, Freud, in exploring and writing about all of the important issues mentioned by Keith 418 in the last podcast, including the role in society of what Reich termed orgastically potent individuals. Despite the fact that numerous writers have pointed out the unique relevance of Reich's work to all magicians, and to sex magicians in particular, his work is still not widely read or discussed in the occult community. Perhaps your podcast can help remedy that situation. Well, thanks for that. Again, this is an area that I really can't comment that much on. I haven't read any Reich, very little Jung, so I will just let your email stand as is. So thanks for sending it in, Freighter OX. The next one is from a listener named Phil. He's also responding to the discussion of Freud. He says, 93, John, I just finished listening to show 39. It was great from start to finish. I really liked yours and Keith's 418's discussion on Freud, but not tying it directly to libido per se. It placed me in mind of a book I read several years ago, David Bacon's Sigmund Freud and the Jewish Mystical Tradition. Regarding the origins of psychoanalysis, maybe it's Bacon, sorry. Bacon writes that what Freud was really building off was his friend, mentor, Joseph Breuer's, I don't know if I'm saying that one correct, talking cure. The really cool part of Bacon brings to the fore is that Breuer's father, Solomon Breuer, was actually a powerful rabbi in Europe at the time who studied Jewish mystical texts. The proposition that Bacon eventually makes is that the study of the Kabbalah is one of the original sources for psychoanalysis. In the first edition of the book, Bacon, in his foreword, writes that he's not suggesting that Freud was up late nights poring over the Zohar and other mystical texts. There was no evidence that he even had copies of these books. But in the second edition, forwards, he relates a story told to him by someone who knew Freud and was looking through Freud's books and found such text. Not such a ridiculous idea after all. Anyway, doesn't tie directly into the show, but see if Keith 418 has a copy of this book. It's really an enjoyable read. And of course, Lon is always a pleasure. Best to you, sir. And again, such a great show. 93's Phil. Thanks for sending that in, and I'm sorry if I'm butchering people's names. All right. So the next email I want to read is a question from Jason. He says, 93, listening to podcast 35, Keith 418 mentions a title of a book called something like Baggy Maladar, The Scented Garden. Can you please give me the spelling or perhaps the location of the PDF? Thanks for your podcast. Really enjoying listening, 93. Okay, the book is The Baggy Maladar, The Scented Garden of Abdullah, the Satirist of Shiraz, or Bagh-e-Matur, Bagh-i-Mutattar. And the most recent print edition was published by Titan Press in 1991 as a facsimile edition with a new introduction. The ISBN of that is 0933-429-0503. It is also available on the internet in a variety of places. And that is a fascinating book. Crowley goes into a lot of various subjects. Most people focus on the homoerotic aspects of it, and it certainly has a lot of that. But there are a lot of other aspects to it, how to approach divinity, how to do certain kinds of magical practices, etc. So I hope that answers your question, Jason. Okay, the next one is a listener. It says, "Hiya, Ian Santa Clara here. I'm enjoying Thelema Coast to Coast, and a recent episode prompts me to ask the question. You and Keith418 mentioned the online version of Magic Without Tears at Hermetic.com and said that it has a number of errors in it. Could you elaborate? That's the only version I've managed to get my paws on so far, and I'd love to know what issues it has. I'm on the hunt for a print edition, but in the meantime, this is all I have. Thanks." The main issues that it has are tremendous spelling and typing errors. So far, I haven't done an exact comparison between a first edition version and the actual TypeScript, but I'm told that it has lots and lots of errors in it. And I don't know if it's got any sections missing or any lines, anything like that. It's just riddled with all kinds of typos. So that's the best I can do for you, E. And as I said before to Brendan, I don't know if Hermetic.com still has it. If it does, make sure you get a copy. Okay, the next email is from Brian. He says, "I'm quite taken with the music at the beginning of your shows. Can you tell me who the artist is?" Yes, the artist is a gentleman who goes by the name of Phosphorus. He did a long song called The Invocation of Barbarous Names, and that's a minute segment taken from it. The link to his webpage is on the Thelema Coast to Coast website and is in the show notes of every show. So, Brian, you should be able to find that there. All right, the next email is from a longtime listener named Christian. He has a band called The Evolutionaries, and you can get to that at www.the-evolutionaries.com. He asked me to make a note to those who are interested that he has a new album out called Kill by Computers, and the it's a number of remixes with two original songs at the end. And the last song, These Are the Keys, is a meditation upon the powers of the Sphinx, as well as a ceremony he used for the creation of a sigil. He thought people might enjoy that and might be interested in know. And that is up on his website. It is a very limited release, so people might want to go check that out. Again, www.the-evolutionaries.com. All right. The next email is from Greg. He just wanted to let people know that he has a new podcast out. It's called A Cult of Personality, a kind of a play on Cult of Personality. And that's at www.occultofpersonality.com, all one word. And he has about five podcasts out, and he interviews various people within occultism, esotericism, and the conspiracy groups, and talks to them about a number of subjects. So I wanted to let people know about Greg's new occult podcast. So go check that out. And the last email is from a listener named Jeff. He emailed me to let me know that he was going to the Czech Republic and that he was going to be looking for a Liber All. Unfortunately, he didn't find it. He writes, "I recently returned from Prague, and I regret to inform you that I was unable to obtain a copy of the Book of the Law in the Czech language. To be frank, I was very surprised that I was unable to find it, and moreover, I was rather surprised to see that Crowley was rather unknown in the country. I looked in several bookstores throughout the country and also made a visit to a very large occult bookstore in Prague, although the shelves were filled with other classics such as Transcendental Magic, Sefer Yetzirah, as well as hundreds of other interesting titles. I found only 4 Crowley titles available in Czech, and I was somewhat filled with disbelief when the shop attendant complained that they were the only Crowley books available in the Czech language, the first being the Book of Thoth, the second being Liber Agape, the other two I did not recognize, and due to the fact that they were translated, I was uncertain of just what they were. My wife is Czech, and she translated the titles to me, and I had no clue what she was talking about. But as I said, the latter two books appeared to be about Crowley and not really Crowley titles. It all seemed rather ridiculous to me. I mean, no disrespect, but I tend to believe that Magic and Theory and Practice, Book 4 and the Book of the Law are Crowley's best works, and I thought it was sad to see a bookstore filled with, from top to bottom, with books that seemed to be in existence in part because Crowley, yet very little from Crowley is to be found, nor did he seem to be known by anyone at all. Later the same day, I inadvertently was approached by a Czech magician while browsing CDs in a heavy metal shop. He wanted to talk to me about energy and magic because he claimed he could see my aura. He did not speak English, nor is my Czech worth anything more than placing a beer order in a pub. Well, it's better than mine. My wife began to translate for the two of us. After talking to him for a few minutes, he told me that he had been practicing magic for over 20 years. I, of course, told him that I was a charlatan and that I dabble in hocus pocus merely when I am bored. Well, at least you're honest there, Jeff. At this point, I figured I must be talking to someone familiar with Crowley, and perhaps he could direct me towards a copy of the Book of the Law, but always he had no idea who Crowley was. However, he knew of John Dee and Edward Kelly. But Edward Kelly is something of a legend in Czech. Even my wife's somewhat village parents knew who Crowley is, as he was made into a character in a popular Czech fairy tale. However, the first thing out of everyone's mouth was that Kelly it was a charlatan. They also have liquors named after Kelly in Czech. The label claims that it is the perfect alchemical mixture of herbs and spices. I doubt it, but I bought a bottle anyway. At any rate, I included a few pictures of the house that Kelly lived in while he was in the service of the king. The right tower was his. I hope you enjoy. Jeff. Thank you very much, Jeff. That's great that you went to look. It is very disappointing that Crowley is virtually unknown in the Czech Republic. This kind of goes along with what Keith and I will be talking about later in the podcast about how the Crowley books are going out of print, not just in English, but they're virtually unknown in Europe. And this does not bode well for Crowley and the future of Thelema by all of these books going out of print. So thanks for sending that in. I know it was rather long, but I hope everybody enjoyed it. And it was fascinating to know that Edward Kelly was such a well-known charlatan in the Czech Republic. So thanks again, Jeff, and thanks for looking for the Liber All, even though it did not materialize. All right, moving forward, I now need to apologize to everybody. Yes, it's been over a month since the podcast came out, and I said it would be coming out sooner. Well, the reality is, I just don't know when the podcast will be coming out anymore. It's mostly based on the fact that it's the end of the semester. I've got about another month and a half of school, and then I will be graduating with my undergraduate degree. I will have a few weeks off, and then I am moving to Europe. Where I'm going to be going to graduate school for a year. So as you can imagine, things are getting pretty hectic for me. I'll be doing my senior project and another few papers for some classes I'm in. And then I have to dispose of my 10 years worth of property in the house that I own. and decide what I'm going to sell, what I'm going to keep, and make all of the arrangements to move to Europe. So, plus do that with a job and a few other projects that I'm working on. As you can guess, that keeps me kind of busy, and I don't know where the podcast is going to be able to fit in all of that. I hope to come out with one, you know, at least once a month, but at this point, they will just be coming out when I have time to put them out. And I hope everybody can understand that. You know, it's been a busy time. And the next one, show 41, will be the 2-year anniversary show of Thelema Coast to Coast. So if anybody has anything they want to say regarding Thelema Coast to Coast and its 2-year anniversary, get that in the mail, email, or through the website or whatnot. Get that to me so I can read it on that show. As I mentioned before, I have started a Thelemic announcement e-list called Herilieu. You can get to that by going to www.thelema.nu/Herilieu. That's H-R-I-L-I-U. And you can sign up for that. It does not go out that often. You will not be getting a lot of spam. In fact, the list is not going to be shared with anybody. I'm the only one who has access to it. And right now, only one email has ever been sent to it, and it was in mid-February. So as you can see, there's not a lot of traffic on it. But I do send out a lot of good information, and I have another one that will be going out in a week or less. So you might want to go and sign up for that, I'll send that out. All right. The next thing I want to play for you is some samples from some songs that were done by the Russian OTO. I announced this in the last Herilieu with a link, but the songs are just so interesting that I wanted to make the Thelema Coast to Coast listeners. The Russian OTO translated the Invocation of Pan, the Creed of Liber 15, or the Gnostic Mass, and the Anthem of the Gnostic Mass, and One Star in Sight, and set them to music. So they have released a version of all of those in both English and in Russian. Each one is done in a very different musical style. And so I really like the Invocation of Pan, and in fact, that is what I'm going to be playing at the end of the podcast. But I want to play a small segment right now of each of the four songs. It's about 30 seconds for each segment, and just so everybody can hear it, I'll have a link to their website in the show notes, where people can go and download the full versions of each song. I just think it's pretty cool that they're out there doing this kind of work. So here are the segments. And again, the order is the Invocation of Pan, the Creed of Liber 15, the Anthem of Liber 15, and then One Star in Sight.
Thrillingly song, last of the light.
I believe in one secret tale, in a fable lore, and in one star, in the company of stars, of whose fire we are created, and to which we shall return. And in one father of life,
mystery of
in his name.
Glory to me.
letter. The has no read nor riddle to fight.
I hope everybody liked that. It definitely is a very different sound, and I appreciate the creativity of the Russian OTL Thelemites. Going on to the next thing is the, I just want to remind everybody of my blog. Because there is significant breaks between the podcasts, I do update my blog a little more often, maybe once or twice a week, with my thoughts either on kind of the state of Thelema or various things, or some personal updates on where I'm at and what I'm doing and so forth. So if people want to check that out, it's easy to get to www.thelema.new or thelema.com or thelema.info or thelema.biz or, yeah. So any of those will take you to my blog. So anyway, thelema.nu. All right. The in the last podcast, I had Lon Duquette on, and we were doing a giveaway for a copy of his Accidental Christ. That was given away. Anthony in Eagan, Minnesota won that. So congratulations, Anthony. Now that we're a little over 20 minutes into the podcast, almost 30 minutes into the podcast, we're now going to be starting the interviews. The first one is with Monica Rocha. She's a member of the Hermetic Order of Rahur Kuit, and recently she, working with the Hermetic Order of Rahur Kuit, published an English translation of Moda's Astral Attack and Defense. And I was really interested and excited to see that this had come out. This is the first English translation that I know of this work by Moda. And it's got a lot of fascinating things in there. It also has a commentary by Ray Ailes. And so I wanted to talk to Monica and just kind of find out why the book was put out and get some background on it. And so she was nice enough to come on the show. So I have an interview with her. Then I have an interview with Keith 418 regarding the Crowley books. We talk a bit about what Brendan asked. And then lastly, I have an interview with Alfred Vitale. And we discuss a paper that he gave at a conference during the last summer regarding the modern use of media as magical tools. And in particular, he concentrated looking at like Kenneth Anger and Grant Morrison and so forth. But we have a very interesting conversation about that and a lot of other things that are involved in that subject. So here is the interview with Monica. And then from there will be Keith and then Alfred.
We have on the phone with us Monica Rocha. Welcome to the podcast, 93. Now, you worked with Headland Press and recently released an English translation of Moda's Astral Attack and Defense. Why did you choose to translate that book in particular?
There were many reasons to do so. I think, number one, the first thing I thought about was the fact that this book was the last book that Moda wrote. In Portuguese, at least, was the last book that he wrote and that he published, at least in Brazil, which was in 1986. I got a hold of the book in 1987, right around January of 1987. And this book had an enormous significance to in Brazil for Brazilian aspirants and other people interested in the occult and in Thelema in general, because Moda basically took a lot of his knowledge and his excellent background in all the subjects that are discussed in the book, and he comprised them into a very accessible language. And at the time, I was a young college student, and I was able to read through so many times, and I had no problems understanding what he was talking about. So that, given the fact that, first of all, Moda puts a lot of his knowledge in here, comprises a lot of different subjects, and at the same time, the historical significance that this book has for Brazil was really one of the main reasons why I thought was important to bring it to the audiences in the United States.
Now, this is
and abroad, of course, in English in general.
Right, and this is the first English translation of this.
It's the first one that I know of. I mean, if there are other translations out there, I'm not aware of them. It took me 5 years to get this translation done.
Wow.
And the reasons being that it took so long is because, you know, I kept on revising. I I started working on it, and I felt like in order to have the book, to have a more validity for the audience of this day and age, I needed to add something to it. Therefore, I was able to get the collaboration of Freda 939 Radios, the overseer of the Holy Order of Rahokrit. And I thought that by adding Ray's commentaries and his recent research on some of the subjects that are written in the book, I thought that it would add a lot more value to audiences today. Because in a way, not that the book is dated, but a lot of things that were that Moda talked about, I think if he were alive today, he would want to see them brought up to date as they are right now.
And what kind of response has there been to the book?
Great responses. I think one of the things that, you know, given the sad circumstances of what happened to Moda in the United States and the lawsuits and the fact that he had he was taken away all of the rights that he had to work with with the LTO so-called and all the proceedings and the legal lawsuits and everything else, one of the things that I thought it was cool about this book is that Moda, this, it's not one of the books where he's talking about those things, which towards the end of his life were really, really becoming a central part of his writing, you know, like the fact that he was, you know, extremely annoyed at everything that had been done to him with very good reasons to be. And this book is just very clear-cut. He just talks about the subject. He's not, you know, basically mulling over some recent events that had just happened. It doesn't get caught up on that. It just goes into, it flows really nicely, and it's very anecdotal. And I think that's what grabs people's attention. Like, for example, we have been, myself and the lodge master of the Children of Zion Lodge, the New York Lodge for the Holy Order of Rahokrit, and some other members, other brothers from our lodge, we have been going around and doing workshops with the book, and we have gotten a really great response. From,
great.
You know, lay audiences, sometimes pagan audiences, people interested in Wicca. We were surprised at how many people have been attracted to the title because of the title itself, you know, not because Marcelo Moda was the one who wrote it. You know, if we just limit ourselves to the audience of people that know Marcelo Moda and that know Thelema, I think we are not going to reach out to as many people as we would like to.
Right, so a broader audience allows you to you kind of get these ideas and actually the techniques that Moda talks about in here to defend themselves.
Exactly. And I think when Moda put this book out, and this is one of the things that I say in my preface there, is that Moda was hoping to do something with a little more commercial value, and I'm putting commercial in quotation marks here, because in a way this was a book that he was hoping to reach out to lay audiences in Brazil, or at least people generally interested in the occult or in magic or in Astro Attack and Defense. So I like it. I like this this quality about the book, that it has this kind of inner, you know, jargonish kind of element to it, but at the same time, it has a broader audience in mind.
Now, this was published through Headland Press, and they've also come out with a previous book that you...
No, this was not published by Headland.
Oh, I'm sorry, it's not.
This was published by the... It's a Holy Order of Rahokrit publication.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Is Headland just handling the distribution of it?
No, they're doing some of the distribution, yes. Yes, Gregory von Seewald is one of our brothers, and he's helping out with, especially with European distribution, but we have various distributors. We have J.D. Holmes carries the title. We have been distributing ourselves. If you go into our website, www.hor.org, there is a link in there where you can order the book by PayPal. So we just kind of are going all over the place.
Oh, okay, great. Hor also published a number of years ago in kind of the same paperback format, Calling the Children of the Sun, that also has a number of translations by you.
Yes, yes, yes. That was a book that I also got a copy of the original from Brazil, I mean a photocopy. There were very few of them available. Very few people have a copy of this book because Calling the Children of the Sun, when Moda published it back in the day, this was before I was born, was like in, I believe, 64, you know, or like right around the revolution, you know, the military revolution. Moda apparently threw away a lot of the titles because he was afraid that you know, the military was going to go after him, and a lot of people had to go in hiding at around that time. So those were very repressed times in Brazil. So some people that were in contact with Moda at the time claim that that was the reason why he took the book out of circulation, because he had to sort of, you know, back off and for fear of persecution, which was very common to people that held, you know, ideas contrary to the regime at the time in Brazil. And back in the late 90s, somewhere around 97, we got a copy of the book from Euclides Lacerda, who was, you know, whom we were working with at the time in Brazil. He was a Moda student back in the day, and he had a copy of that book. So I said, you know, I'm going to go ahead and translate that into English. But, of course, that was not the only existing translation. There was a translation before, and that book was published through the Headland Press. And we have a bilingual version of it that's actually in Portuguese and in English.
Right, yeah, that's the version that I have. And mm-hmm. and I was wondering, did you put that out in the bilingual, too, because the Portuguese version is very rare.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, it's extremely rare. That's the reason why. And also because we were thinking, you know, we were working with Brazil also, and we figure, you know, this book will have a validity to, like, different, you know, for Brazil and for the U.S., or for American English-speaking audiences, let's put it in general, and Portuguese-speaking audiences. I mean, I cannot limit myself to Brazil, but let's say Portugal mm-hmm. and Angola and Cabo Verde, you know, places where Portuguese is spoken. And it's very exciting because I just learned that our brothers and sisters from Poland, who have a temple in Poland, they have translated this book into Polish.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, so it's great that you bring this translation into English, and then all of a sudden, you know, other languages are coming out of it, and I think that's a very exciting thing to see happen.
Well, what's your next project, since you've just finished this up? Are you going to be translating anything else?
Actually, I'm working on a document now, which is a lot of the work that I do in my profane life has to do I do a lot of, you know, I'm an educator, I work I teach, and I do a lot of studying on intelligence and brain cognition and stuff like that. So I've been working on a document on Thelemic political morality, which Moda wrote back in 64. So I'm doing a revision of that document because a lot of the concepts of intelligence that Moda was talking about at the time are still, again, you know, more research needs to be done. You figure that 40-somewhat years later, things change a lot. So I'm doing a lot of research in this area of intelligence and human intelligence and how it applies into a Thelemic society. So that's one document that I'm working on. And also, we have been working on an upcoming title by Freida 939, which we hope to publish again this summer. And that title will be named Magic Revised by Freida 939, so we're hoping to have that one out sometime in August or September.
Now, the Holy Order of Rahu or Kuwait, they have locations worldwide, isn't that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, we do.
And they're also, you know, actively doing a lot of other publications. I'm looking in the back here of the mm-hmm. The Astral Attack and Defense, and it's got a number of books listed, including German and Polish versions of Liberal and mm-hmm. And other things. So so it's very active in its publishing.
We are, but the interesting thing is that now what we're trying to do, we're trying to become more cohesive in terms of how we bring ourselves together. You know, we have people in Germany that have been working very hard, and most recently we've had a growth spur in Poland, and the Polish people have been working so hard. They've been they have their own printing thing going on, and they put their books out, but we never sort of said, you know, well, we can kind of list everything that we have.
Mm-hmm.
We've been, so that's our challenge now, is to try to work as a cohesive order where, you know, all the publishing goes into, you know, everybody's aware of what we're doing, whereas before was like, you know, we have a more of an informal network of publications, but right now we're steering more towards this thing. And also we have in our website, www.hor.org, we have our newsletter, which is published every 3 months, which is the Warriors LVX, is our official newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
And we have tons of articles, a lot of poetry, a lot of things that different members write from different parts of the world, and that's accessible to the public as well.
Okay. So it just sounds like you guys are going through the normal process of growing pains and,
yes,
and getting organized that way.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we are. Like, I think I mentioned this to you in our previous email conversations. One of the things that, we don't appear to be big to the one who's on the outside, but, you know, there's a lot to us, more so than a lot of people know of, you know, and I think it's, you know, we don't advertise ourselves, I believe, enough, because I think, you know, in a way, being from the Moda lineage, I think one side of us, we cannot help but be very defensive about,
mm-hmm.
you know, what the kind of stuff that Moda went through. So I think we are cautious, I would say the right word for it, in terms of how we, approach the whole idea of, you know, making ourselves this big public entity. You know, we just basically are there, and people that are interested will find us. That's the way we look at it.
Fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm really excited that the book came out. I was actually informed about it from Roger at Magus Books in Minneapolis. He's the one who told me about it, and as soon as I found out, I ordered a copy.
Great.
And figured, oh yeah, this is definitely something you should be aware of. And I don't know if you're aware, I've already with the Hurulu mailing list that I do, I mentioned it in there and kind of refer people. So I'm just really excited to see it coming out, and I encourage you all to keep doing the work that you're doing and keep producing. It's fantastic.
Thank you very much. Well, keep an eye on our website. Like I said, we have a book coming up in the fall by
right.
Shada 939, and we're trying to keep our lineage going, keep Marcelo Moda's work alive, and I think if he were alive today, he would be still doing a lot of work. He was extremely prolific,
mm-hmm.
in his writings, and I think one of the things that Shada 939 says in his preface is that, you know, in spite of the resentment that surrounds the work that Moda did, and you know, we are, as an order, are trying to say, you know, it's not about that. You know, we're out there, and we're very friendly people, and we're just there to contribute to Thelema in general, and be friends with, you know, whoever wants to come to us. We're, like I said, we're very accessible.
Well, let's talk about the content of the book. So there's a number of prefaces. You
yeah.
have one,
mm-hmm.
and then Ray Eales has one, and
yeah.
then you translate Moda's editorial or
mm-hmm.
introduction.
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes in. Now, in the beginning, the first four chapters is, according to the introduction, it seems to be based on Dion Fortune's work.
Yes, yes. Uh-huh. And that's one of the reasons when I mentioned to you that it took me 5 years to get this book out, is that one of the things that when I first presented the manuscript to Shada 939, he read it and he said, this is too much like the first three chapters. He said, this is too much like Dion Fortune's work. I'm not going to go there. And then I kept saying, no, please get past the third chapter and the fourth chapter, and you're going to see that it's not the case. Okay, and then finally, it took me a long time to convince him, and then finally he said, yes, I can see there's so much value to this work.
Mm.
I will give you some background of how things work in Brazil, and I would say in Latin America in general. Basically, a lot of times, you know, at the time the Moda wrote this book, this was during the military dictatorship, and there were very few books available in Portuguese on the subject. And Moda was trying to shed the light on magic and the Western magic tradition in a way that had never been thoroughly discussed before and to the public in an open way that Moda proposed to do with this book. So in Latin America, very often, this is by all means not plagiarism, it's just a cultural thing. People have the tendency, and if you live there, if you know anybody that's from there, or if you read anything, there is this tendency to take the work that is existing and sort of like paraphrase it and make it into something that is accessible to the local audience.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Like, this is just the tradition. That is something that happens there. And even Moda himself, when one of his conversations with his students, you know, back in, I believe, in 1980, EZ in Tennessee, one of the things that he says is that Astrotech and Defense is very similar to Dion Fortune, if you take the, you know, the Unfortunes Christism out, you know, like Astrotech in the Past is similar to that. Yes, we realize that. The first three chapters, there's a lot of paraphrasing going on. However, the validity of the book does not diminish because of this. First of all, because that's just three or four chapters.
Yeah, and it's only like out of 50 pages.
And second, the fact that it was done in Brazil at the time, you have to keep in mind the audience that he was looking at. He wasn't looking at publishing this in the United States, you know, in English. He was looking into publishing that in Brazil at the time. So for people in Brazil, I mean, my brothers and sisters in Brazil, they always say this is Loda's best work in Portuguese. Mm-hmm. I mean, he did such a huge favor to the Portuguese language by coming up with this. And as a matter of fact, the Unfortunes book, as far as I know, and I've done recent research, does not exist still in Portuguese.
Mm-hmm.
So Moda took some of that, translated, used his own anecdotes, and then built upon it to get into the parts that are originally, you know, just pretty brand new material from that point on, pretty original. So I think if you keep that in the back of your mind, you will understand the cultural context
mm-hmm.
under which this was written.
Right, but then he's got, you know, a huge number of chapters afterwards. I mean, it's a total of 10 chapters, so if you take out the first three, I mean, he still has a pretty sizable book. And
exactly.
Then there's even appendices that you have, various other essays that he wrote, like
mm-hmm.
on wine and strange drugs, or drugs in the astral body.
Yeah, those were by Freider 939.
Oh, those are Freider 939.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Because there were a lot of the commentaries by Freider 939 are in italics and bold.
Uh-huh.
And and he mentioned some of those essays within those commentaries. Therefore, he needed to put them as appendices so people could refer back to them as they read the book. And, of course, we also have one mode of appendix, which is the Field Theory of Sex, which is a
yes.
very famous document that Moda wrote way back in the day. And there is one chapter that is on sex and the occult.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that particular appendix relates to that chapter, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay. Yeah, I read that one, and I thought that was really a fascinating essay of his.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, in some ways, it's very transgressive against societal norms.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And I think the fascinating thing about Marcelo is the fact that he always looks for a balance on things, you know, and I think in this case, you know, he criticizes harshly Brazilian society, you know, and the double standard that exists in terms of how homosexuality is treated, and, you know, how women are treated. And Moda always kind of went for the jugular, you know,
mm-hmm.
when it came to certain things. You know, he would just, like, go straight to the very core of the subject. And I think it's, in a way, you know, anybody in Brazil reading this can say, you know, yeah, that it's true. You know, we are a society that has a lot of double standards. And
well, I mean, it's your Roman Catholic heritage
exactly.
that is a lot of that.
Yeah, a lot of that. But the interesting thing is that if you read through, one of the things that I did as a translator that I thought it was important was to bring up to date some of the things that Moda mentions in the book that happened back in the 60s. Like, for example, one story where a girl from the northeast of Brazil that attended Catholic school, Roman Catholic school, had to have their, you know, their private parts inspected to make sure they were virgins. You know, they used to do that on a regular basis. Something like that does not exist anymore. So a lot of the things that I do under translator's notes is that I try to say that, in fact, since Moda wrote this book, Brazilian society has changed enormously. That has been a significant sexual revolution. That, you know, things have changed a lot and very good in a much more positive way. In
Fantastic.
A more positive way. So I sort of bring some of that up to date. And, of course, some things have not changed yet. For example, James Fraser's book has not been yet translated into Portuguese, The Golden Bough.
Right.
So things like that are still sort of behind, you know, in terms of things that should have happened by now are still not there. But I'm glad to report there has been some progress.
Now, how large is the esoteric community within Brazil?
Within Brazil, it's very interesting. Brazil is like has various, you know, the same as in the United States. I would say, you know, the the three main lineages, which is, I would say the Caliphate and the Moda lineage and the Kenneth Grant lineage. You know, in Brazil, there are those three lineages work, people doing work for those three. It's a lot more flexible. There are many, much less division than there is here. You know, people that are part of one thing work with the other. So they tend to be friends among themselves. You know, they tend to be like a, you know, whoever works with the Grant work there, my friends with the people that do the Moda work. Mm-hmm. So I would say this, it's pretty large. You know, it's pretty, I cannot tell numbers, but I would say it's in the hundreds, you know, mm-hmm. but people that are more like solidly involved with it, but people that are interested in it, it's very hard to say. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to say. But São Paulo, Rio are the main places where they have, you know, more functioning lodges, more functioning people doing work in a more systematic way. And they're, you know, they once in a while there's a book that comes out. There are some translations. I believe the Caliphate has done some translations of the holy books of Thelema in Portuguese and you know, the Book of the Law. And of course, there is also still the Nuit Lodge in Ribeirão Preto, where Moda had his original lodge. It still has some of the Moda books that once in a while, you know, they have a website and they still distributing some of the Moda publications, which is great. You know, there's still that going on. So, you know, I would say it's fairly large for Latin. It's probably the largest one in Latin America, that I would say undoubtedly, that Brazil, because of Moda, has been the largest growth of Thelema in all of Latin America. And also because I think it's a more modern society, you know, as compared to a lot of those other countries. You know, it's a more liberal in many ways. So I think Thelema has more of a chance to kind of, you know, grow, whereas a lot of places are a lot more conservative than mm-hmm. Brazil.
Great. Well, I'm kind of running out of time here. Was there anything else you wanted to have people note?
No, that's about it. I mean, I invite everybody to check out the book. I think, you know, there's a lot to be learned from it, especially from the footnotes. Footnotes are
great. Yeah, it does have a massive amount. I mean, almost 200, oh, just over 200.
Exactly,
footnotes.
Exactly. Well, the thing that I wanted to, as a poetic license, the book was not edited. We did not have an editor, so we edited ourselves. So there are some mistakes here and there, because Ray and I ourselves, we did this work together, Freda 939 and myself, and it just got to a point that we worked on it, and at one
right.
point we said we're just going to have it out there. So,
right. It is hard editing your own material.
It is
you overlook things quite
yeah,
frequently.
Very difficult. So we had a choice of, like, either while I was in Brazil to have the book printed and brought it back to the U.S., or either wait another year and have somebody go through the entire painstaking process
yeah.
of editing. So we just said, you know, we're going to focus on content mostly, and I think that the value that the book has overrides any sort of mistake that you'll find here and there. But hopefully after we sell this edition, we'll come up with the second edition.
How many did you print?
We have 500.
500. Fantastic.
Yeah, well, they're going very fast, so I invite everybody to check out our website. Again, I'm going to give it
right. Please do give it again, and I'll also have a link
okay.
in the show notes.
www.hoor.org.
Fantastic. Thanks again for being on the podcast.
Thank you, John. It was a pleasure talking to you.
93.
Thanks to Monica Rocha for being on the show. I really appreciate you taking the time and kind of not only explaining the book, but also giving a little background for those who don't know about the Hermetic Order of Rahuakuit. And there will be a link to the book and ordering information in the show notes. The next interview is with Keith 418. He and I kind of get involved and really take a look at what may be going on with why the OTO is not publishing the Crowley books, what their motivation or what their problems are. And we give a good bit of information and also do some speculation on it. So here's the interview with Keith 418.
Keith, 93, welcome back to the podcast.
93, John, thanks for having me.
Earlier in the show, I played a listener feedback from a listener who has been kind of frustrated about the OTO's lack of publishing, the books going out of print, the OTO not coming with new books. I think the last book they published was the astrology back in 2003, so 3.5 years ago. What is the impact, in your opinion, about the books, and why do you think that they're not coming out?
Well, there's a couple of things that I think we need to look at when we examine this question. And first of all, you know, I want to say at the onset that I used to defend the organization purely based on the fact that it was publishing great books. And when people would complain about the OTO or the people in it, I would say, look, you know, some of your complaints may be valid, but the fact is, if you like Crowley, you have to buy the books from us because we're the ones who are publishing them, and they're great books, and even our critics use them all the time. And you can see this looking online. People who hate the OTO still have to go and buy the OTO's books if they want to read this Crowley material. So that was always something that I think the OTO had in its favor, and I think that the leaders should be really commended for the fact that they did work so hard to get this material into print and that they did publish the books. Now, we can look at some of the books they published and critique them, particularly the first edition of Book 4, which I think Hymenaeus Beta should be deeply, deeply ashamed of because of the typos and the mess that it really was. And I have a copy of that, which I, you know, if I feel like confronting him and saying, give me my money back.
Yes, I have one too.
Crap, right, because it's filled with typos and it's a total mess. And he's never really apologized or acknowledged that that book makes him look pretty bad, and I think it does. I think it makes the order look bad, too. But balanced against that kind of embarrassing mistake are some other really great books that we use a lot, and so on the balance, I think, you know, they deserve a lot of praise. That said, the books not coming out is a big problem, and I think people need to look at the fact that the biggest issue with this, to my mind, is the fact that the members of the OTO themselves weren't buying the books.
Mm-hmm.
We did the analysis of this, and if there's, you know, 2,000 people, 3,000 people in the OTO, and the first press run of a book is 1,000 copies, and that first press run doesn't sell out very quickly or even over a period of years, it means that people in the OTO aren't buying the OTO's own books.
Right.
We found that this was the case all over the place, that people who were members for a long time, people who, you know, seemed to be the very backbone of their local OTO community, were completely disinterested in shelling out for the books. So if your own members aren't buying the books, you've got a problem. And mm-hmm. I think part of that problem has been compounded, I wanted to say, by the fact that the leaders themselves really don't make an effort to make the books and the texts an essential part of the culture of the OTO. Instead, they work along with the rest of the people in the community to make the books optional or something, you know, of antiquarian interest to a few members, but not something that is a vital part of the community. And consequently, it's not really surprising when you see most of the members refusing to buy the books or apathetic about them, because the whole culture of the OTO as a community isn't really focused around the material in those books anymore. So on the one hand, yeah, it's really lame that most of the members aren't buying the books, but it's also really lame that they don't feel like they have to, or that the books and the material in those books aren't a vital part of the community, because in a lot of ways I don't really think they are. So there's that issue. The second issue that I think we need to look at, too, is the fact that I don't think a lot of the leaders in the group are really that interested in Crowley anymore. At one point they were. They produced some great material. But over time, you can see this sort of lack of interest. They don't really care that they don't have all the diaries or that there's never been a collection of Crowley's letters. And when we find new Crowley material out there, unpublished stuff, they're not really that interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of the problem why this is happening is that they have got to live up to the material in the books. If they're the only legitimate OTO, if they're this important repository of Crowley's legacy, it's just more than publishing the books and having people read them. They have to live up to the material in those books, and they're going to be judged and held accountable by the material in those books.
Well, I
think they resent that.
Well, held accountable, nobody in the order is holding them accountable.
Oh, we are.
I mean, in 1998, Hymenaeus Beta sent out a letter saying all of the books that they were going to publish, they were going to do astrology, they were going to do a series of a collected diaries, a complete edition of Confessions, other important publications of historic importance, multiple languages of Liber All. How many of those books have come out?
Astrology came out.
Exactly. One. Of all of these, that was 9 years ago, and none of the other books mentioned in here have come out. Who's holding them accountable for that? Who's saying, hey, you promised us this almost a decade ago, and it hasn't come out.
Right.
And I mean, we've gotten a new list of you know, a new wish list or you know, how they're hopeful in the foreword of Wasserman's new version of Aleister Crowley and the Practice of the Magical Diary. So now they're promising a complete edition of Akkad's Master of the Temple, Equinox 3-2 to be released, and a whole bunch of more. I mean, there's all this new material. I got an email from Hymenaeus Bader recently that he said there's about 2,000 pages of new material and an equal amount of reprint material. Well, where is it? I mean, they've had all of these things for so long. Why are they not putting it out?
Well, we hear from some of the leaders that they don't have the money for it.
Well, I asked Hymenaeus Bader that directly. In fact, I offered to help him get the money to print the books. I said, look, you know, I can get the investors. I've got the experience with Luxor Press. I can get the Crowley books out. That's not a problem. He said money's not the problem. He says the OTO has the money, but they've had other priorities lately. Which,
well, again,
really
what's weird
strange
to me is that you've got his people, you know, the people that serve immediately under him, saying the problem is we don't have the money.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have him saying to you, oh, we have the money. That's not the issue. So to me, there's like either one of these groups of people is wrong. Either Beta is wrong or his followers are wrong. And you have to wonder, why aren't they all on the same page about this? You know, we've looked into this and we've said, if money is a problem, why aren't they asking us for the money?
Well, they did. And at the end of that 1998 letter, I mean, he says specifically, we need your financial support to continue. Have they asked us for money since? I think, honestly, they're afraid to ask for money.
Yeah,
because
it's a
huge button issue for so many of the members.
Yeah,
I mean, even the local dues issue is...
It's a huge issue.
Right.
Yeah. And again, if they ask us for money and then the books don't come out, then people are going to be angry at them. And if you burn one investor who's angry, or you burn one publishing company who doesn't want to work with you anymore, that's one thing. If you've got a significant number of people who, you know, are the kind of people who will respond to a request for money, and they're all mad at you, that's a very different situation. And I mm-hmm. think if a lot of people felt, you know, that their money wasn't being spent well, or that the group was being irresponsible with the money, they would be much more inclined, perhaps, to listen to our criticisms and take them seriously. So, I mean, this is the kind of, like, scaling back of expectations that we see, this perilous spiral into lower and lower expectations where, well, you know, maybe the books don't come out for another 10 years.
Well, it gets worse than that. I mean, Hymenaeus Bader specifically said to me that he thinks the future of Thelema is in college libraries. He says the libraries are the future of Thelema since that's where the kids can first read the books. How many libraries are really going to spend money on Crowley books? I mean, libraries have so little money, they're not going to go and purchase this obscure material. And even if they do, the first person who checks it out is likely to steal it.
Well, that's often the case. That's true.
This kind of misplaced priority or this kind of cluelessness, what is Hymenaeus Bader thinking? The future of Thelema is like Thelemites, like the members of the order?
But look at the situation he's in. He's published the books, and he knows that the members themselves aren't buying them. So what else does he have to do but to grab at any straw, like the idea of getting the books into libraries? If he can't sell them to his own members, the absurdity gets even more when you think to the point where we have fought all these lawsuits, and the OTO has spent all of this money and this time and these resources hiring lawyers and filing lawsuits on two continents at least
mm-hmm.
to secure the copyrights for books that their members publishing. Have no interest in buying.
Oh, I mean,
what kind of group does that? That's insane.
Well, we're actually working to create huge vacuums from Crowley. The Secretary General of the Order, when he was part of a previous organization in Germany, did all of these translations that this clandestine group claiming to be the OTO was publishing. The OTO has since shut them down. So now there's no Crowley in German anywhere. So the shelves are empty. How do you get a future generation when there's no material for the people to read?
I was in Paris last year, and I couldn't find Crowley books in any of the occult bookstores I went to. There wasn't even a copy of the Thoth to Rodak. They had no idea who Crowley was in a couple of the ones I went to, and these are some of the most prestigious occult bookstores in Paris. They had wonderful collections of other material, stuff that was really great, no Crowley, nothing.
It's creating this huge vacuum.
But I think in a lot of ways this is deliberate. I mean, I can't help but think, maybe even on an unconscious level, they've just decided that they don't like Crowley that much and they don't really want these books out there, that they're going to be held accountable, that people will read the Crowley material and say, wait a minute, you're not doing that, you're not doing this. You know, we heard an account recently, we saw an account of the Solar Lodge, where once the Solar Lodge members started reading the Crowley material for the first time, they started arguing with their leadership, saying, you're doing stuff that Crowley says you're not supposed to do. It's not in that book. This isn't in his book. He says this. He doesn't say that. And at that point, the leaders came and they took all the Crowley books away.
And locked them up.
Locked them up and said, you can't argue with us.
Right.
And in a lot of ways, I see the same thing going on in this OTO. It's on a more subtle level. But rather than the sort of cult-like attitude of the Solar Lodge, they're not publishing Crowley material that they've got, because maybe they don't want us to read it and go, wait a minute, this is not what you're doing. And anyone who argues with the leaders gets in trouble. Either they don't get promoted, or if they're above a certain level, they get booted out.
Yeah.
So the effect is the same. And I kind of feel that the lack of books is a symptom of this distancing that's going on, where the leadership of the order is slowly pulling away from Crowley and from Thelema. And if you think I'm wrong about that, if anyone thinks I'm wrong about that, well, one of their own bishops admitted that this was happening.
Yeah.
He said, yeah, this is a trend in the order. They're moving away.
Yeah.
This intellectual migration, ideological migration, as I call it, away from Crowley and Thelema, is really, you know, creates symptoms like the books going out of print, because the books are only going to go out of print if people aren't really interested in it. And they're not.
Right. And then they're compounded by the fact that they're so litigious and they've scared anybody who wants to do any kind of Crowley work. The books are disappearing.
Yeah, but look at how sad this is. The Blue Equinox, which the leaders claim is their model for the OTO, did come back into print recently.
That is correct.
So people can say, well, Keith, you know, you're wrong about this, because obviously this book is back in print, which shows that there's an interest. However, the OTO, even though it claims that this book is the model it wants to use, had nothing to do with this new edition.
That is correct.
It was published by Weiser as a facsimile of a book that's in the public domain. And, you know, as we've seen, the OTO promised a list of all the books that it claimed it had copyrights on, all the Crowley material it claimed it had copyrights on, and a list of everything it acknowledged as being in the public domain. That list has never appeared.
In response, they said it was too hard to create that list, and so that each and every person, if they want to publish something of Crowley's, has to ask.
Right.
I mean,
but
that's a significant intimidation.
Again, you don't have to publish a book
that's
in the public domain.
That is correct. But
if someone tries to scare you out of publishing a book that's in the public domain, they could get into quite a bit of trouble.
Wow.
So it's very dicey to try to do that. But again, Weiser evidently saw that there was a market for this book, perhaps among OTO people who were interested and wanted a copy of it. We know people who bought it. They put the book out. The OTO had nothing to do with it.
And it's still a $40 paperback book.
I mean, how sad is that when the book that the OTO claims is so important to it has to be published without its direct supervision, no added notes, no introduction?
Mm-hmm.
It's pathetic.
Yes.
And again, I can't help but see this as a symptom of an organization where most of the people are critical of Crowley, they're really not excited about Thelema, and the leaders are burned out by it. Maybe they produced great material 10 years ago, 15 years ago, but now they're just, it's not a priority for them anymore because they've seen how hard it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's like they're halfway up the mountain. They don't want to go back down, but they can't move any further up.
Well, I think they also have some logistical problems. They've alienated New Falcon. They've alienated Weiser. They have their Thelema Media, but Thelema Media is not making any money. They have, you know, some old stock of the New Falcon books that they purchased, but those are dwindling quickly. And the one book that they published, the Centennial Liber All, it wasn't that impressive, and it was over a year late. So they released their Centennial Liber All a year after the Centennial.
Right, but look, even the books that the OTO has published recently in Australia and in England, you were the person who designed those Libra out.
Well, that's correct. I'm the one who did those books for them, yes.
Right. So the high degrees in the OTO, the people who have book publishing experience, who are, you know, supposedly these vast initiates, who lorded over us, you know, with every opportunity. They could not be bothered to do this important thing, but the person that the OTO saw fit to boot out, in part because of your writing, that's the guy who gets to do these books? This the level of insanity here, you know, beggars belief.
Yes. It is kind of...
And I mean, to me, magically, what does this really say? If they're not invested in creating the most important book for the order, then obviously that indicates that they're moving away from it, that it's something that's uncomfortable for them, and it's not what they're really interested in anymore. And this is what I think you can really look at in terms of the whole slide of the OTO into irrelevance and scandal and drug problems and all these other issues, is really the fact that the people in it aren't really that interested in it anymore. They're not really invested in it. If they were, they would want to see these books back in print, and they would be angry that they weren't. If they were, they would be demanding that the unpublished material be published so that they could study it and learn from it. And they're not.
Yeah. It is very disappointing, but hopefully that will change soon. Hopefully enough people will raise their voices, or maybe the OTO will take me up on my offer and, you know, work with me, and I certainly can get the books in.
Yeah, we keep hearing different stories. You know, on the one hand, we hear that they want to do these hardcover library editions for university libraries. On the other hand, we hear that they're coming out. I heard a rumor that they wanted to do mass market paperbacks really cheaply, and that that was going to be a project that was coming out soon. You know,
I think there's a place for
about this. I want to see some results. I want to see a schedule and a timeline, and I want to see people being held accountable to it. And if they need the money, I want them to ask me for the money. Set up a web page where we can donate via PayPal.
Well, again, we'll see how it goes, but the money really isn't a problem. The books could be made available if they wanted them
to. Oh, sure. No, I realize that. I just think we need to eliminate money as the issue, to clarify that and eliminate that,
yeah. So
that finally some of them will admit, you know, we just really aren't that into it anymore.
I'm not going to hold my breath for that one.
Yeah, we'll see.
All right. Well, thanks again for being on the podcast.
Thanks 93. For having me on. 93.
Thanks to Keith for being on the show. And now we move to the interview with Alfred. Alfred presented, as I said earlier, at a conference, a conference about esotericism in the summer of 2006. And during that time, he presented about using mass media, like books or film or other ways of actually being magical sigils or talismans or being magical rituals themselves, and how the viewers or the readers are participants in the rituals. And it really kind of struck me as a very fascinating concept. So Alfred and I discuss that, and we touch on Spare, and then we kind of touch about on a number of other related subjects, technology and the current state of people and how the occult communities are producing and what they're producing. So here's my interview with Alfred.
We have on the phone with us Alfred Vitali. Are you there, Alfred?
Yep.
93, welcome to the podcast.
93, hi.
Now, you're a doctoral student in human development at the University of Rochester. And this summer you gave a presentation about using, I guess, media as a ritual tool. And you use some examples of figures like Kenneth Anger, Grant Morrison, and so forth, kind of talking about the way that they use the media, film, print, graphic novels, etc., to as like magical talismans. What kind of brought this to your attention and you know, got you looking at this?
It began with, actually, I was taking a course in cultural studies. And one of the things I found interesting was that cultural studies often refers to occultism in particular, but it's almost always, you know, as you'd expect, disparagingly, kind of, you know, mockingly, et cetera, et cetera. But Kenneth Anger, as an example, this is where it began. Kenneth Anger is considered a very important filmmaker, and especially in cultural studies and visual and cultural studies, his work, you know, is considered pioneering in experimental film. And yet, every time I would read a reference to his work, whenever they discuss films like Invocation of My Demon Brother or Lucifer Rising, let's say, it would have that same mocking tone. And even biographies of Anger, except for one, basically positioned him as a sort of pioneering filmmaker who also has had this kooky, wacky, eccentric occult thing. It was always like at the sidelines of his work. And I would watch his work and say, this is not at the sidelines, it's the absolute forefront of his work. And parallel to that, I was reading, I finished reading The Invisibles, and Grant Morrison had said in a few interviews, and in fact in Anarchy for the Masses, the book that the disinfo guide to The Invisibles, he directly refers to The Invisibles as a sigil. I mean, directly. He says it many times in many interviews, and I started thinking about that. Like, what does he mean by that? So, simultaneously, as I said, I'm studying the work of Anger, and I thought, you know, Invocation of My Demon Brother, I saw it in a film class, or I showed it in a film class with a few students, and everyone thought, this is a film of a ritual, right? It's kind of crazy. But I argued that it's not a film of a ritual, that the film is the ritual.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, we kind of got into these arguments about, you know, how can that be, you know, et cetera. And then I had to give an explanation about magic and such. And so it got me thinking, is this something that people don't get, you know, in the film scholars and such? Are they not getting this? And so that's how it kind of began. I started to look at, you know, if a piece of paper can have a sigil on it in a graphic form, what's the difference between a graphic and a film or a song
mm-hmm.
or any other piece of media? So that's how it began.
Well, let's talk about that film as ritual, because that it brings up kind of the theater of the cruel to me. Whereas instead of the person just watching it passively absorbing it, you know, kind of from this distance, they're actually part of it.
Yep.
So expand on this film as ritual, and what is the part that the viewer plays in the ritual?
Yeah, well, there's two parts to that, I think. In general, if you just take any film, no matter what film it is you're, you know, going to see, Flushed Away or even a cartoon, you know, you go to a theater, so you consciously prepare yourself to enter a space that is dedicated to a particular act. When you get into the space, the lights dim, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everyone is focused on one thing. It's a collective sort of thing. And at some point in the film, you sort of become a collective mind focusing on this. And you're all, in many ways, in the same place, just like a group ritual would be anyway. And, you know, the ritual has its action. Things go on throughout the film that cue you to feel certain things, cue you to think of certain things. Then the film is done. And there's almost a banishing. The lights come up. You know, it's like a bell rings. The lights come up, and then you get up and leave the theater and you feel transformed.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, in a very literal way, the act of going to a film is a ritual. In this particular case, let's say with Anger, take something like Lucifer Rising, or actually Invocation of My Demon Brother might be a better one. I'm looking for a quote that he actually said about that. But the film is something that's shown specifically in theaters that are a little more marginal.
Mm-hmm.
It'll never make the Cineplex. Okay. That means that already the audience is a sort of receptive group of people. They're going to see this film because Kenneth Anger is this important filmmaker, or, you know, there's a lot of different reasons, but Kenneth Anger is already positioned, in a sense, as a sort of orchestrator of this ritual. They go to see this. Now, Invocation of My Demon Brother, he said he wanted to invoke the Luciferian angels. He says there, you know, I'm an artist working in light, and that's my whole interest, really. Lucifer is a light god, not the devil. The devil is always other people's gods. I'm showing actual ceremonies in the film. What is performed in front of the camera won't be a reenactment, and the purpose will be to make Lucifer rise. So taking the idea of Lucifer and the rebellious angels, taking this, watching this film, he is basically trying to create rebellious angels. And even watching this film, which is replete with, you know, very strong and graphic images of different things. I mean, it's a shocking film for many people,
yes.
And a lot of his films are. So, I mean, he really is attempting to create in the film, in the viewer, rebellious angels. This is a sort of packaged meme in a sense, right? This is a way to stimulate people to be those rebellious angels. So it's not, so you're participating. I mean, when you, as I said earlier, when you go to a film, you're already participating in the ritual of a film. In this particular instance, I think because Anger creates things with a magical intent, creates things with a magical, in a magical context, I think he's completely aware of your position as the viewer of this film. And so he is acting like the priest. In fact, Haller wrote that to screen this film and subsequent works is presumably to join Anger in his role as priest, magus, magician.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think this is an accidental thing. I think these are conscious attempts to bring about sort of rebelliousness and various ideas. I mean, that's part of the reason people shock in most art, is to generate some kind of transformative or, you know, jarring moment in the viewer.
Now, you also mentioned Grant Morrison. His medium is very different. He uses graphic novels, and he has a series of them with the Invisibles. Now, in your description of the participants all coming together, all kind of having a group mind, it's all very focused, and you have this community observing, the film. Whereas Morrison is producing his talismanic creations individually, and they're consumed by the readers in a chaotic, haphazard, non-unified way. So what kind of effect does that have instead?
Well, he, and in The Invisibles in particular, I said this in the paper, you know, there's a question as to whether, because Morrison treats both the characters in the novel, in the graphic novel, and also even the sort of attitude towards the readers, as if to say, where are the Invisibles? I need to contact the Invisibles. The Invisibles need to be manifest somehow. And in a way, I feel like what he was asking was, he was actually trying to create Invisibles. I mean, I think he says that explicitly, too, that this was, you know, here's an example of something that he had said in an interview, that he said, the invisible style hypersigil requires a very close personal involvement with and surrender to processes occurring within the text, which sets up a bizarre and wholly magical feedback between the real and imaginary worlds until it becomes impossible to tell them apart. And I think Morrison writes The Invisibles in a very sort of, there's an ambiguous idea of whether or not he thinks Invisibles actually exist, or is he making Invisibles through this comic.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the idea of the mirror, which is the emblem, the badge that the Invisibles have, I mean, it's, what is a mirror? I mean, is actually in one of the pages in the graphic novel, is just like the mirror is facing us, you know, as a reader. So he's sort of, and he's treating us as if maybe we are the Invisibles. And he does blur the idea of reality and imaginary. And so I don't think he needs to have the concentrated audience that a film does, because he designed the comic to basically engage each individual viewer as if they are an invisible.
Mm-hmm. Now, and he also has a longer progression. Instead of an encapsulated 90 minutes or 2 hours, he's got this over a series of books. So it actually has this larger feedback loop and a larger time of kind of deployment within the minds of the readers.
Yeah. Well, early in the series, there was some possibility that the series was going to be canceled, and that he had asked his readers. Again, another one of those things I wish I had. I didn't think about this. He'd asked his readers to basically charge some kind of sigil or talisman. Basically masturbating, you know, using fluids and such to charge these talismans to bring back the Invisibles. And, of course, the Invisibles did not get canceled. So, I mean, even that, he sort of invokes, he treats the readers as if they are magical participants and active, you know, agents of magic. And so that was definitely a way of connecting the audience directly. The other thing I noticed that, you know, if you see pictures of Grant Morrison, he looks just like the main character, one of the main characters, King Mob. You know, even Morrison then is trying to sort of blur the distinction between the comic and the reality, whatever it is.
What you're describing, though, seems to me to have a larger manifestation kind of in media in general. I mean, a lot of companies kind of use this technology to market things or to, you see these memes or memes on blogs, on all kinds of places on the internet to kind of have this viral transfer of ideas or mentality. I mean, whether it's selling Gap jeans or whether it's, you know, wasting people's time on their blog and
right.
filling it up with, you know, what's your favorite anime character?
Yeah.
They, you know, these kind of things propagate in the minds of people.
Yeah.
So I it seems to me that what we have are particular people who are more plugged into using that into kind of transferring their ideas into people. I mean, recently I was talking to somebody about the Da Vinci Code, and you know, and this person was like, well, look, it's a terribly written book, poorly edited. The story is not, you know, the ultimate story of like the bloodline of Christ is not new. It's been around for 20, 30 years. But what did Dan Brown do that was different from everyone else? He was great at marketing it.
Yeah.
And by the marketing is what charged it, by getting that out there.
Because of people using it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then also the reaction, kind of like what you were saying, the transgressive nature of Anger's work and engaging the participants, it does the same thing with other people.
Right.
I would say Harry Potter kind of does the same thing. You get these people who are pro and these people who are con, and whether they're, you know, with it or not, they're all putting energy and kind of charging the talismanic entity.
The significance this to me, that brings up the point about, well, then what makes it different? And I think an important distinction here is, because Anger's work here, Grant Morrison's, I'd say maybe Alan Moore's, I'd also bring up Robert Anton Wilson, their work is purposely designed, in a sense, to liberate one from dogma, let's say, or to in other words, it's an ironic thing, because we're buying these products, we're buying the Invisibles comics, we're buying, you know, but yet the goal is to sort of liberate us from that kind of blind ideological following of consumeristic memes and such. Like, in other words, they're trying to inoculate us by making us rebellious. If Invisibles are about anything, it's about a form of rebellion, and it's the same with Kenneth Anger's films.
Well, I would wonder if they're trying to get rid of ideology. I think they're trying to change people's ideologies from one to another. I don't know if you can actually get rid of an ideology.
You can't. Exactly. Well, they're trying, but they're trying to all right. That's why I said it's ironic, because in order to, you know, Crowley, another one, you know, many people, especially in the last 125 years or so, have sort of set out to liberate us. I mean, even people like Foucault and sort of like postmodern thinkers set out to sort of liberate us from these kind of shackles of being led about by people whose sole purpose is to fill their pockets. The problem is, in order to do that, they need to use medium, which are consumed products. And so I think, especially Grant Morrison, because he writes, you know, I mean, Invocation of My Demon Brother, these things are, you know, 30 years old now almost. So, in fact, they are 30. So it's a different time, whereas Grant Morrison is a chaos magician. He's very plugged into technology and media and using it, and so his direction of liberating us from it sort of presumes that we're already consumer culture people.
Mm-hmm.
Anger wasn't necessarily in a realm where that would be the case, and in fact, you know, you couldn't buy his films, let's say, when they were out. You know, it's not like a comic book. So two different things, but I think the sort of overall message would be to, you know, resist being led about by them. And it, I mean, you know, Morrison's book, Anarchy for the Masses, which the Guide to Invisible, I mean, it's a great name, you know, Anarchy for the Masses.
Now, you mentioned Alan Moore, you know, his books or his graphic novels are being remade into movies. V was done by the Wachowski brothers. You know, what's going on with Moore? I mean, is he as, you know, do you think he's as plugged in as Morrison is on using his medium as ways to transfer these kind of ideas?
I wonder. I mean, he and Grant Morrison sort of come out of the same, you know, milieu, the same sort of cultural period and locale, in a sense. So I don't, unlike Morrison, however, who was very explicit about his aims and his goals, Alan Moore seems to be a little more tight-lipped about that part of it. It's clear, if you've read Promethea, I mean, it's pretty clear that he's really diving deeply into creating a sort of, you know, an occult realm in the novels. I mean, it's really hard to read Promethea and not recognize the absolute depth of his commitment to his practices and to his ideas. So I don't think it's much different. What's interesting to me is that the Wachowski brothers apparently had approached Alan Moore to do another film or something before they did The Matrix. I'm not sure what it was about, but interestingly to me that The Matrix and The Invisibles have many similarities that people have often pointed out are a little more than coincidence. In The Invisibles, the sort of chosen sort of savior person, Dane McGowan, is brought up to this rooftop and thrown off a rooftop in order to, just like
right.
Keanu Reeves. I mean, there's a lot of things. King Mob, the leader of the Invisibles in this particular setting, has sunglasses, a bald head, and a leather jacket, much like
mm-hmm.
Lawrence
Morty,
Fishburne does.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's no doubt that they had read either. So I think there's a connection there, and I think that Moore was, Alan Moore is probably plugged in, maybe not so thoroughly as Grant Morrison. But
but to what end are these disparate people working? I mean,
yeah,
I'm not going to, kind of conflate them all and say, oh, well, all they're working into this, unified end or anything. But what are they ultimately trying to do? Are they,
mm-hmm.
If you say they're trying to liberate the minds of their readers, I mean, are they really liberating it? I mean, is this really a technology that kind of like, rubbing two sticks together that ultimately is a technique to get someone in a particular place that ultimately kind of burns itself up? Rubbing
mm-hmm.
two sticks, they ignite and ultimately destroy themselves. Are these technologies going to destroy themselves? Are they going to liberate people, or are they just going to enslave them in a different way?
Well, that's a good point. But you also presume then that there is an end goal in mind. I mean, in some sense, it's sort of planting. I like to think of the meme, the viral meme bomb, like it's planted and then they run away. Well, let's see what happens if it explodes. Like, things haven't been working so far. Many parts of our world are really crumbling under the sort of, our Western culture. So what if we were to do something that scattered that? What if we did something to change paradigms instantly? That's why I think that with Morrison's statement about it being the sort of like hyper sigil, he actually said in another quote that the Invisibles is to, I want to say, magic what the Manhattan Project was to the bullet. He was trying to really make a point that this is supposed to be have this impact where it frees us from conventions of some kind, I guess. But as to your point about, does this just lead to some... That's something Robert Anton Wilson struggled with, too, I think, in a lot of the things that he wrote. It's like, and the people he discusses, like Leary, McKenna, and those folks, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is liberation not a worthy end goal in itself? Is the process of practicing freeing ourselves from those kind of things not a worthy practice in itself? And can it be transformative both in society and in the individual?
Well, see, I wonder if that's kind of naive. I mean, freeing themselves to what end? If you get out of jail, you're free out of jail, and you're no longer, confined by that, but now you're in society, and there's going to be in another kind of prison. So, I mean, unless you have some kind of teleological end or some kind of morals and values or structure that you're replacing one to the other, if you're just kind of like, well, let's just tear up the structures and see what happens, well, I mean, you're ultimately going to have another kind of structure form, whether it's intentional or organic.
Let's use the better metaphor to me might be a baseball game.
Uh-huh.
So, we can, we're all playing a game, and this is the problem, is that we all play the same game. Now, some of us are better at it, some of us have better equipment, and a lot of times all we do in struggle in our life is just to get a better turn at bat, just to have a better position, et cetera, but we still keep playing the game. What I think people like Morrison and Alan Moore and Anger and other people like that are trying to do is to show us a different game.
Okay.
Now, we might be playing a game, that is true, but the fact is the game that we're playing sucks. I mean, the game that we're playing is futile and failing, and yet we don't stop playing the game. And so I think they're saying, like, look, there's possibilities. And I want to say what I appreciated about both about these people, too, is that it's very collective. I mean, the Invisibles is all about collectivity. Invisible cells have five people, and they're networked with others. Anger's Films, these have participants involved. I mean, collectivity, to me, is the sort of the best inoculation against a lot of the problems with which they're trying to liberate us from. And so, I think it has potential. I don't think it's... is it futile? Will it work? Probably not work if your goal is to change the world, but...
What do you mean the collective? are they trying to say individuals kind of organically working together, or are they trying to put kind of a group before the individual?
See, that's why that's the anarchy part. I mean, I think it's voluntary collectivity that's not based on coercion or peer pressure. That these are, you know, these are. I mean, in a way, it's an affinity group. An Invisibles group is an affinity group. They're although the way he positions them in the comic is they're pretty much just marginal people who are really pissed off at society and, you know, figure, and in a way it's nihilistic. I mean, you figure, look, we're fucked anyway, so let's at least have fun doing it, or let's at least, you know, like, it's like, I guess I'm saying, like, if I'm going to go down, I'm not going to go down without a fight,
Okay.
And that's a very common tactic among disenfranchised revolutionaries in general, you know, like, okay, I've got nothing to lose, so I'm going to throw rocks at the tank.
So do you think they're really marketing their sigils at the disenfranchised, or are they ultimately trying to, to get those enfranchised and get them to leave the status quo?
Yeah, that is a great question, because honestly, I don't know, because I don't know how – there's no class-based – although, wait, let me go back. Grant Morrison, coming out of that sort of British punk 1970s chaos sort of origin thing, I mean, I don't know what his background is. I know in England there was a center, the Center for Cultural Studies, I think. There was an emphasis on working class sort of revolution, and that's what punk was about. And so I think initially they came out of a disenfranchised mindset, maybe, and that changed. But that's a good question. Because,
so do you think there's some kind of Marxist underpinning to all of this to challenge
I don't think
the,
so. Collective
culture?
No, because that, I mean, using Marxism as the framework is just like the baseball game analogy. Like, well, you're kind of really just, you're playing cricket now instead of baseball. You know, you still use a bat and a ball, and you still have to go to work and come home and commiserate about the fact that you worked 8 hours and your back is killing you. I don't know, but I mean, when a collectivity to me, I'm thinking of it more anarchistically and more organically and more smaller, too, is the other thing. I don't think it's a global idea. I think this is a, you know, local community idea.
Okay, well, let's talk about some of the other ways that these things are kind of manifesting. So you've got kind of television shows, or you have novels or books or graphic novels in Morrison's case. How do you think these creators of these products are getting the market to finance them, but also have this subversive or transgressive aspect in there too?
Yeah. Well, you know, perhaps it's partly because the people who tend to have the most power and the most authority over media are not really all that attentive. They don't really see a lot of things. I mean, some things can slip under the radar. And, for example, take Promethea as an example by Alan Moore. It's a pretty complicated comic. I mean, especially as you get towards the end. You know, chances are, I mean, even someone who cares about this stuff, even someone who's really interested in Kabbalah and occultism and stuff, even people like that are not going to catch everything in there anyway. So imagine if an attentive eye is overlooking some things. Imagine what half-assed eyes are doing. You know, most people in the media look at very... This is one of the examples, I think, why Morrison's got it right. There's a lot of things that can go on under the radar because they're looking for certain things. In this case, you know, I think one of the anarchy for the masses idea is to have... is to be collective but not be sort of embedded within the system to be collective. Like, in other words, we're not forming a nonprofit organization. Mm-hmm. We're simply five people who are friends or who look like friends. Or
right, so they operate under kind of the radar.
Yeah, because it's predictable, and that's to me, I think, the greatest triumph of all of these kind of works is that it does sort of dispel us from predictability. It does push us away from doing predictable things.
But do you see there's actually kind of an affinity there with how terrorist groups and terrorist cells work?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I don't think that's an accident that either have functioned that way. It's because it's the only way it's been effective to make change. I mean, you know, you can try to make changes in society through, you know, sort of public organizations, you know, take groups like the NAACP or something, and you have you develop strength through your numbers, you develop strength through your lobbying efforts and stuff, but life moves at a snail's pace. Mm-hmm. And for our generation, a snail's pace is too slow. People want to see things now. So we have to figure different means to make noticeable changes. And so I'm hoping that, you know, people will start to see that giant mass actions can only accomplish so much. It's the little clusters of people doing stuff under the radar that really get in their craw.
Well, how do you think technology, I mean, general technology, not magical technologies, but just computers and the means of production being in the hands of you know, people readily, how do you think that has changed all of this?
Well, it's gotten good and bad things, because while it has given people the ability to make connections that they couldn't, and obviously, as we're doing right now, you know, communicate in ways that were completely impossible even not that long ago, I think we often forget that technology is built, manufactured, and owned, and advertised through large companies. I have web access at home, but I'm paying Time Warner Cable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so yeah, I'm liberated, but I mean, I don't say I'm a neo-Luddite. I'm not one of those people who's willing to say that technology is going to be the liberating factor in all this, because technology to me is like having an aluminum baseball bat or a softball, you know, whatever. It's like having better technology to play the game.
But you still have to be a good hitter.
You can do some things. I mean, you can certainly. You can steal a base, you know, you can do some things, but essentially you're still using their products. And it's been happening, you know, for 25 years now, this sort of idea that the internet is going to make the world a democracy, but it really hasn't done that at all. It's just exacerbated the conditions that are already screwed. There's a gap between, you know, poor people still don't have access to these things, you know, it's still the domain of certain people.
Mm-hmm.
And so in terms of the readers look, who's reading Grant Morrison's work? Who's watching Kenneth Anger films? I can tell you is probably not the majority of Americans.
Right.
In terms of economics and social positions and stuff.
So again, that kind of goes to the disenfranchised or those who are already predisposed to the message that Morrison and or Anger is presenting. They're already self-selected, your affinity groups that you're saying.
Yeah.
So in some ways, you got to wonder, are they just preaching to the choir?
Yeah. Oh, I think they are. I think that's. But are they preaching to the choir out of convenience and just simply that's, you know, is it Kenneth Anger's job to sort of make people able to afford seeing his films? Or, you know, that's not his role or his job, so he's going to operate with what he has available, and that happens to be his audience. Never mind these people, just look at anything. How many things are actually sort of movements that are for, by, and about disenfranchised people?
Mm-hmm.
That is a condition of society, not media necessarily. So, I don't know. I mean, I guess, are we arguing about the success or failure of these to actually come?
No, I'm just wondering, it's like, how useful are these things? And, you know, I'm just kind of going through this process, thinking about this with you, and it just seems to me maybe the best that these producers can do is better enable their already predisposed group or affinity group and maybe give them more tools or better tools to kind of manifest in this world or give them a different way to approach reality and or investigate it.
Or maybe they're just like acting as cheerleaders to goad us on further or something. But, you know, again, I'll harken back to what I said earlier. You know, I think pretty much most of us who think at all recognize that in a lot of ways we're often fucked. And that's mm-hmm. just it. And so how do we go out? You know, I consider myself a Discordian at heart. So I know we're fucked. I would much rather enjoy the time being fucked than to not. And if enjoyment to me means getting together with five of my friends and, you know, doing a ritual and doing stuff that's kind of, you know, a little on the margin there, that's okay.
Well, I guess I'm not as nihilistic. So.
I know. It sounds, but you know, it's not pessimism. I don't think it's nihilism or pessimism. I think it's a sort of healthy dose of acceptance. Because it doesn't preclude me from trying to change things. It just means that I don't get disappointed when I fail,
mm-hmm.
which I think is one of the attitudes. I think, again, maybe the people like Anger and Morrison, because they're not political people, they're not purposely going into the realm of politics, I think they recognize the degree of failure that they face.
But, well, then what about an artist like David Tibet? Would you kind of put him in the same kind of category?
Perhaps. I mean, I don't know what his particular... I mean, I know what his music like. I know what his ideas are. I don't know exactly what he thinks an end goal would be, or, you know, if he's trying to liberate or not or what, but I don't... I suppose there's probably a lot of people like that. I mean, that's... To some degree, isn't all art like that? We're not gaining anything by it. We're simply making the world a little more aesthetically enjoyable, or hopefully. Let's have a nice look. I mean, you know, would you rather go down in a flaming pile of shit, or would you rather go down in a hedonistic paradise?
Well, I wonder if those are my only two choices. But
I was just saying, you know, you said Marx earlier, and I was thinking about what, you know, not I don't consider myself a Marxist. However, there's something that he said that I think is often overlooked when he discussed capitalism, and I think what he was saying was that when capitalism becomes universal, when it becomes all-consuming to a point when no culture is free from it, when it has completely overrun the entire world, only then can the natural revolution occur to change that. Because capitalism thrives on having people to exploit.
Mm-hmm.
And once you've exploited everybody, then what?
Right.
But thankfully, for capitalism's sake, thankfully, people are constantly trying to rebel against it in ways that are quite predictable, and so it's like having a built-in revolutionary. You know, we know they're going to keep doing this, or it's like a game that just keeps getting played. And I think the Morrisons and the Angers are kind of saying, like, there's other games, maybe we could just ignore them for a while.
Well, okay, we
I'm being optimistic. I'm being very Pollyanna-ish about it. I mean, I know this isn't. I'm giving them a lot more credit than they probably deserve. But.
Well, let's, you know, keeping with this Marx thing, well, let's look at these technologies as kind of commodities, and how I guess, you know, the thing that keeps coming back is who is producing these objects, these talismanic objects, regardless of what medium they're in, you know, I don't see a lot of people producing them. So in the end, you know, you're still going to have kind of this hierarchy of those who are producing it. You know, we're talking about Kenneth Anger, we're talking about Grant Morrison, we're talking about these other producers.
Yeah.
We're not talking about Joe on the street, because he's consuming it, he's not producing it.
Exactly, yeah.
So I guess there's always going to be this hierarchy of those who produce versus those who consume.
Right. But maybe there's also a question as to what's being produced and what's being consumed. Like, what is Morrison producing? Is he producing a comic book, or is he producing knowledge? Is he producing... I mean, there are other things that get produced. And one of the things that Marx didn't have at his time was an information economy.
Mm-hmm.
So his means of... his production is very very physically based, very material-based production. As we know, it's a lot different now, and the production of knowledge is a whole different ballgame.
Well, then, that ties back to how technology enables the more average person, or to use Marx's terms, you know, the means of production are now in the hands of almost anybody, or at least it's broader.
There are a lot more factories in that sense than there was, in the metaphorical sense, there are a lot more producers, a lot more smaller producers. But, you know, the difference, too, is, okay, maybe that's true, but how many people produce information now? Adbusters had an article a few years back where they looked at what was called the mindscape. Marketers were looking at children, let's say 10-year-olds. What percentage of their information is coming from what corporate entity? And it would say, like, for an average 8-year-old in America, you know, 30% of their information comes from Disney Corp. You know, 20% comes from Time Warner Corp. Another 50, you know, and
wow,
it's mapped. It's scary, but, you know, in reality, I mean, this is why I talk about with technology that I don't think we need to depend. I don't think we should look to it as being a liberating thing, because how much percentage of, I mean, who is doing tech? Who is using the internet? Let's say completely free of any corporate influence, whether it's from the production of the machine to the communication lines to get to these, you know, it's just not possible to extricate yourself from that kind of connection. And so because of that, it's predictable. And so this to me is not the idea of the meme bomb or the thought bomb, the viral bomb, because it's predictable. I mean, although I have to say computer viruses, now there's a bomb. that's one that unfortunately does its job too well and affects everybody, which is not necessarily what we want.
Now, one other aspect that you talk about that we haven't gone into is your paper actually starts off by talking about Spare and his techniques of creating kind of a talismanic object or something like that. It just seems to me kind of like all of these producers are using various chaos magic kind of techniques to I guess create their bombs in the minds of the people.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I mean, I think they're taking what Spare did of, you know, his technology and his ideas and applying them on a larger scale. Certainly. I mean, I think it's great because they're not necessarily self-directed things. I mean, these are directed outward. And yes, one could argue that, well, you shouldn't interfere with the wills of other people. It's, you know, which I would say, yeah, when you find me a world that doesn't do that, then we can talk about it. when you tell me you went on vacation to Disneyland, you have now affected my will because now I'm thinking about Disneyland. To go to Spare. The reason I brought up Spare was because, well, Grant Morrison is a chaos magician by name, and by, you know, it's clear that he is. So that was why I kind of looked and saw, well, what does Spare do to create these things? I mean, Spare was also an artist. So in the presentation I did, as you remember, I made a PowerPoint presentation of a sigil. Mm-hmm. Where I started off with determining the magical intention, and I just wrote criticize Bush, which at the time seemed like a fun thing to do. Still does. Then I, you know, using the technique of eliminating duplicate letters and then arranging the letters into a shape, et cetera, and then stylizing the shape and et such. And so at the end, as you saw, I had this sort of salamander-like thing, which looked like a little cartoon character. And I was doing this because the audience for this is not necessarily an audience who would know what a sigil is anyway. And so I had to kind of do this in the most basic way possible. And it helped, I think, because I couldn't have done the presentation without it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a sort of scholar on Spare, so I couldn't really speak for his ideas so much, but the practice is very common nowadays, as you know, and so it's useful.
Okay. Well, I think this has been a fascinating discussion, and, you know, it's been great to have you on the show. If somebody has more questions, how can they get in touch with you?
My email address, it's actually my name at Yahoo. It's Alfred Vitale, AlfredVitale, one word, at yahoo.com.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
I'd be happy to talk about it with you.
Well, I really enjoyed your presentation when you gave it this last summer.
Yeah.
And you know, this has been a fun conversation. I hope I haven't been too adversarial or anything.
No,
like
you haven't been adversarial enough. I think you're being a little patronizing. No, I'm kidding.
No. Well, sorry about that. No.
No, it does illustrate, though, how, you know, depending on what you see as the end, you know, and again, because I consider myself Discordian, I just would rather run in circles forever than think there's an answer, because every answer I've found for everything has sucked or has failed or so, you know.
All right. Well, we'll let the listeners kind of go from there and, you know, send us feedback and or you email. So thanks again for being on the show, 93.
All right, no problem. Thanks, 93.
So thanks to Alfred for being on the podcast. Also thanks to Monica and Keith 418. I know today's podcast has run a little long, but, you know, being that one hasn't come out for a little over a month, I didn't think that'd be that much of a problem. I do want to play one other little musical segment of a little over 30 seconds. This is from a listener named Greg, who's part of Group 362 Dada. He sends me a CD every now and then, and it's got all kinds of various stamps on it and artistic representations of things about Dada, Neo-Dada, Fluxus, and so forth. And I recently had a chance to go to the Getty Museum earlier this month, and I saw an exhibit about Neo-Dada and experimental art movements in post-World War II Japan. And a lot of this kind of stuff was involved in that. So I'm a little more knowledgeable about this subject matter. I already knew about the original Dada and Duchamp and so forth, but I'm getting a little more informed about that. And so what's funny is Greg sends me a CD every now and then, or a postcard, or something else from the Thelema's Dada Wing. So I wanted to play a small segment of his latest CD that he sent me, a song called Harit SB 10. So here's a small segment of that. So thanks for sending that in, Greg. Keep them coming. I love getting the CDs and the other things you send me. And I'm glad I was able to play a little of it this time on the podcast. Again, I don't know when the next one will come out. Hopefully, it certainly will be within the month of April. And if it doesn't come out before the Holy Days, I wish everybody a happy Thelemic Holy Days. And I hope everybody had a great equinox. And the next podcast will be in April, celebrating the 2 years anniversary of the podcast. So do send notes in. And as I said, the closing is Iopan by the Russian OTO. So thanks again for listening to the podcast and putting up with how long it is. Love is the law. Love under will.
With the
Drumslometry. Come, 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 come with the flute and come with the pipe. With beak and claw, the god is true, the great is scum, he appalls. I am burned to death on the hog of the unicorn. I am thy major, and thy man. God of thy flock, I am Galt. God, flesh to thy bone, power to thy road. With hooks of steel, I race on the rock. Throw sauce thy starboard to equinox. And I wrath, and I wrath, and I reap, and I ran. Everlasting world without end. Mannequin, maiden, maiden.